Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Teenage girls are infamous for making negative remarks about their bodies. Comments such as, I look like a cow or I'm such a pig are not uncommon, but it's hard to know when this kind of language signals deeper problems. Our next guest has firsthand experience with the warning signs and destructive course of anorexia, both as a heart surgeon and as a father who lost his daughter to that disease. Dr. Ismael Nunya is author of the book, The Spirit of the Heart, Stories of Family, Hope, Loss, and Healing, and he joins us now from Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, Dr. Nunya.
Thank you very much, Anne. Thank you for having me in the program.
Your daughter, Catherine, died from complications of anorexia when she was 18. That was several years ago in 1998?
Yes. She started when she was 14, and it was a very insidious type of coming on of the symptoms. She told us one evening at dinner time that she and some of her friends at school were going to go on a diet because they looked, like you said, they looked like horses, and they ate a lot, and they had to go on a diet. And my wife and I looked at each other. We thought, this is really, really strange, but we didn't think much of it. And in the course of the 4 years, she began to drop weight. She began to eat foods that were very low in calories, and her caloric intake was very, very low. Her exercise was very aggressive. She would get up at 4 a.m., go running, unbeknownst to us, and she would go up and down the stairs. But all this time, she was a straight-A student, a wonderful daughter, beautiful little girl, but she had these changes coming on.
When did you first know there was a problem? A real problem, not just a, gee, that's kind of strange.
You could see it in her weight, her clothing. And I began to see when I would give her a hug, I would begin to feel her spine. Not that I could do that before. And also in her face, you could see her drawnness and her cheeks, spaces below her eyes. So it was a very marked change progressively. If you saw her one day to the other, you could not tell. Mm-hmm. But if you saw her after perhaps a week or a month, you could definitely make the difference.
1998 is a long time ago when it comes to our understanding of anorexia now and other eating disorders. At the time in 1998, and those 4 years previous when she was going through anorexia, what did you know as a physician and a parent about what to look for? Is it something that was the visuals and the, you know, being able to feel her spine when you hugged her? Was that something that triggered, boy, I better think about this. This might be anorexia.
You know, I contacted fellow physicians who were pediatricians. I was a cardiac surgeon, but they were pediatricians, there were nutritionists, there were therapists, and everybody would look at each other, and it was not an epidemic as it is now, and they would talk about it. Some of the pediatricians even had children who were also anorexic. Some of them had children who were bulimic, who would eat and then produce self-emesis compared to not eating. But it was very little known at that time. We took her to Children's Hospital National Hospital in Washington, D.C. That's where I was based. And they had a very nice metabolic unit, and they had therapists, and they had nutritionists, pediatricians, and it was a very well-concerted type of an environment. But just this morning, just before going on your show, I read an email from a colleague here in town in Los Angeles who has a girl that's anorexic, and she's been trying to place her in some type of a metabolic unit, and there are very few and far between, and the requirements are very, very high. to put them in there, i.e. insurance problems, Medi-Cal problems, problems with the fact that, well, maybe she's not that anorexic, you know. And so she, this colleague's about to throw her hands up and ask for mercy. And what that tells me is that throughout the country, we have not evolved that much, and it's a huge wake-up call to me. She's contacted a lot of universities throughout the country, and many of them have turned her down. So there's still a lot of work to do.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the disease anorexia with Dr. Ismael Nuño. He's the author of a book about his life. It includes a chapter about his daughter who died from anorexia. The name of the book is The Spirit of the Heart, Stories of Family, Hope, Loss, and Healing. Dr. Nuño is also a medical advisor for the Alfred Mann Institute of Bioengineering at the University of Southern California. Some researchers are finding that those who suffer from an eating disorder such as anorexia show less than normal activity in the hypothalamus, the amygdala, and hippocampus areas of their brains. And conversely, those who suffer from an eating disorder characterized by an insatiable appetite show higher than normal activity in those areas. What do you know about that? And about, and that's not necessarily the case with everybody, too. But where, if you knew that then, I mean, might you have thought your daughter was suffering from something like that, or was it more of a psychological issue?
Yes, and if you take a look at the at what's available on the internet and other world literature, it goes in waves and it moves back and forth. It was believed that this was in highly socioeconomic level type families where the father and the mother were high-ended money makers, and they would stress their kids out. From there, we went to the fact that there was a physiologic and anatomic changes in the hypothalamus and the amygdala, and so these children were given Prozac as a neurotransmitter to increase the activity of those centers. And if you take a look at the literature again, it goes back to the fact that parenting is a very important part to this element. So it goes back and forth. But I, as a scientist, am convinced that there is a neurotransmitter deficiency, that there is an anatomic change, and I, for one, would support research along those lines.
Catherine was hospitalized several times during her illness.
Yes, she was, and to the same unit. We were living in Washington, D.C., where I was in the military in the United States Army. And when I finished and we came out to back to Los Angeles, where my wife was born and raised, we started to set up our home here. We moved, and Catherine went to UCLA as a student. She was a student. She loved her classes. She loved going to college. She had a lot of friends. And through therapy, she was given instruments to fight the disease herself and to improve on her deficiency. And she did that. Her friends told us, gee, you know, we're really happy because Catherine had a bite of pizza today with us. And so they were all very happy for her. But she started developing problems where she would not really faint, but she would almost pass out. She was taking a final exam at UCLA. She passed out, and she was taken by ambulance to the emergency room. And there she was worked up quickly with an EKG, a physical examination, electrolytes in her blood. Everything looked okay, so she was sent home. About a month later, it was really hot and muggy in Los Angeles, and she was outside planting flowers, and she came in and she said, you know, I almost passed out. It's really hot out there. So I said, oh, you know, drink water, lie down, keep cool. You know, as a father, I would do all those basic things, but it never entered my mind, connecting all the dots, that she was beginning to have syncopal episodes. and eventually she had a fatal syncope. I got up in the morning. This was during the OJ trial, so I don't know if you remember that part, but I remember turning on the TV, getting my cereal. I was recovering from surgery myself, so I was at home, and I saw her car, and I thought, this is really strange. Catherine should be at school by now because she had to present a paper at school, and so all of a sudden I had this terrible feeling in my heart. I ran down to her room, and there she was. She was there on the floor. She had no pulse. She was not breathing. So I began CPR on her. And, you know, and I've given CPR so many times in my career, and I've brought patients through. And here is my daughter, and I didn't know what to do. I said, I should call for help. So I ran to the phone. I called 911, and I said, please come and help me. And they said, well, continue CPR. I opened up the door, and they came. And the hardest decision I have ever had to make in my life was to stop CPR. And my daughter, they had to literally pry me off of her. And that was the moment where you understand that it's not to be, that it's she's no longer going to be with you, and you have to, you yourself have to give her up. And it was a terrible moment in my life.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but tell us about what you mean by the syncope episodes. Are you talking about was she still struggling with anorexia, or was she struggling at that point with the after effects of anorexia and the damage it had done to her heart?
She was beginning to eat. That's correct. That's a good question. She was beginning to eat just about every food, so she was getting over the aspect of limiting her calories.
Mm-hmm.
And she was able to eat, and she was able to have more friends, and she continued to do well. Her cognizant reactivity was good.
Mm-hmm.
So she was doing well from all standpoints. The problem was that her heart had been injured. There's a point at which the heart has no protein, and so it becomes protein-starved, and the electrical conduction of the heart becomes very abnormal, if at all. So this is what was happening with her. She was having long pauses where she would have no electrical activity of her heart, and she would pass out, except she was so bright and so cheerful, she never told us that she was passing out.
Well,
she would just say, you know.
We just have about a minute left, and I want to ask you, when you were having her vitals taken during those, the checkups and so forth, was there a way or is there a way for people to know whether or not their child who may have recovered or is recovering and working on recovering from anorexia or some kind of eating disorder, whether or not that kind of damage has been done?
Now there are ways of doing that. For example, all the tests developed were for males, not for females, so we're developing that. And number two, there's Holter monitors that you can do for 2 weeks at a time to see if there's any abnormality in the electrical conduction of the heart.
Well, Dr. Nuño, that's all the time we have right now, but thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate
it. Thank you, Ann. Thank you very much.
Dr. Ismael Nuño, he's the author of the book, The Spirit of the Heart, Stories of Family, Hope, Loss, and Healing, and also medical advisor for the Alfred Mann Institute of Bioengineering at the University of Southern California. Coming up, we have another topic. It's more of a seasonal topic. It has to do with the warm weather emergence of the deer tick. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
The WOSU Public Media Member Card Benefit of the Month for July is the Columbus Children's Theater. Enjoy two-for-one admission to the galleries all month long. Support 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level and receive your member card. Just visit WOSU.org. And thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Columbus Symphony. Picnic with the Pops welcomes Kansas to the Columbus Commons this Saturday, July 6th. Kansas celebrates their 40th anniversary and joins the CSO to perform hits like Dust in the Wind and Carry On, Wayward Son. Details and tickets at picnicwiththepops.com.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Warm weather lures us outside, but likewise, the tiny black-legged deer tick also emerges during the spring, wide awake and hungry for blood. Never once to eat and run, a deer tick can linger long enough to infect their host with Lyme disease, and that's when the problems start. Here to tell us more about the disease, the relationship with the tick, and the recent surge in tick populations in Ohio is Glenn Needham. He is retired from the OSU Entomology Department. After 35 years studying the biology and control of ticks, dust mites, bee mites, bed bugs, and fleas, he is now working with the OSU College of Veterinary Medicine and OSU Departments of Health, Natural Resources, and Agriculture on figuring out the Ohio Lyme disease risks. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Yeah, thanks for having me here today.
Lyme disease gets its name from Lyme, Connecticut, and it's most famously affected the East Coast. But I've been hearing about it for years, and in the last year or so, I understand that Ohio has seen a rise in deer ticks that can carry this, and that's correlated to a rise in Lyme disease. Can you talk first about why is it deer ticks that carry Lyme disease, what the relationship is there?
Well, there are two ticks in the United States that can carry Lyme disease. There's one on the West Coast, and then we have this one here that's in the upper Midwest and the northeastern United States. And they're the only two ticks that can carry Lyme disease, transmit Lyme disease. Other ticks can become infected with it, but don't transmit it for reasons we don't really fully understand. And so it's apparently a recent invader of the state. And the health department has been keeping track of Lyme disease since the early 80s. And back then, most cases were could be accounted for by out-of-state travel history. And the recent trend is to see people with Lyme disease and no out-of-state travel history. They were bitten by a tick in Ohio, became ill, and were diagnosed with Lyme disease. So we see this trend increasing more and more. And most recently, in 2010, I found the ticks that carry Lyme disease, the black-legged tick in Coshocton County, and subsequently in Ashtabula County. And now we're up to 26 counties in Ohio that we believe has the tick.
The tick that is carrying Lyme disease, not just can carry Lyme disease.
Yes, I think that's a...
There's a distinction there.
That's true. I mean, you could have a population of this tick in an area that's not infected. And we haven't done extensive testing of the ticks that we do find. It's one of the areas where you need to do a lot more work to find out what the risk is, to see what percentage of these ticks actually carry the disease.
They're called deer ticks, or do they get... Where do they get the Lyme disease from?
That's a great question. Because of the name deer tick, most people think ill of deer. And they are part of the problem, but they're more large hosts that carry large numbers of ticks that distribute them. But really, the white-footed mouse is the really bad actor in this story, and they're the ones that carry the Lyme disease organism and then transmit it to the tick. So, I mean, we could call it the white-footed mouse tick, but I don't think we're going to get to change that name anytime soon.
The white-footed mouse, it's something they can live with?
That's right, and they can harbor large populations of the tick, and also they get Lyme disease, but it doesn't affect them physiologically. So that's why they're a great reservoir for this disease. And between the mice and the ticks, this is what maintains this zoonotic disease in nature. And then humans become an accidental victim of, you know, a tick bite and getting Lyme disease.
Do all bites from a tick that's infected with Lyme disease result in infection?
No, they don't. And in fact, laboratory studies suggest that even when a tick's infected, it probably needs to be feeding for at least 2 days.
And that's something about a deer tick that's different, because deer ticks, from what I've seen from personal experience, they burrow in so it only looks like it's like a pencil, a dot from a tip of a pen or a pencil in the skin. It's not like the ticks that stay on the outside and get bigger and bigger.
Yeah, I think for one thing, you're right on in terms of the size. First of all, this tick is kind of an order of magnitude smaller than our common American dog ticks around here. Mm-hmm. So we're Ohioans are calibrated to look for big game. These ticks, especially this time of year, are about the size of a pinhead. You're exactly right. And so when you're scanning a dog or a person looking for ticks, you're not looking for something that tiny. So they easily can feed and then drop off without you knowing you even had a tick on you. And then some days later, a couple of weeks later, you start showing symptoms. And you may not even connect the dots literally between when you were outside, maybe exposed, and then the symptoms that you have. And most people get Lyme disease in Ohio and other surrounding states in the summer, and when the tick that's active is the size of a pinhead. So it's not a large tick that we're looking for.
Is there a screen for Lyme disease?
There is. It's actually a process where you do an initial test, and if that's positive, you do a second test to determine whether or not it's Borrelia burgdorferi. And so it's a bit problematical because it's a test for antibodies. And so you don't get an initial response. If you catch this early enough, you won't be positive for Lyme disease. You have to be infected for a period of time before that test is going to show that you're positive.
You're infected for a period of time, even though you may already be suffering the symptoms of it.
Correct.
Will be a period of time before. How long a time is that? Do we know?
Various periods of time, but it's probably at least 2 to 3 weeks, and it may be longer. We all have our own kind of individual responses to any infection.
And then the problem is that if it feels like flu, for a lot of people, they won't go see a doctor. They'll just keep waiting and waiting, particularly if it's not during flu season and no one's out there with any warnings and that sort of a thing. People respond. So typically, when do we have any sense about when people who have been infected, who are suffering, typically seek medical attention?
I think that's the issue. We tend not to want to go seek medical attention. And even then, if you walk into a healthcare professional, especially in Ohio, it's not well known that we have the tick and that we have infected ticks. So you may even present classical symptoms of a bullseye rash, and they may say that we don't have Lyme disease in Ohio. So we're kind of in a dangerous period in Ohio where we have the ticks, we know some are infected, but the healthcare professionals are kind of being slow to respond to this evidence.
I know people who say that they have Lyme disease and others who say they've only have the appearance of it, that there's been no solid evidence. You have to be diagnosed with those tests before. That's the only way to know for sure, right?
That's the scenario, really, here in Ohio. I think if you live in what's called a Lyme endemic area, then it's easier. They may treat you much earlier in that process and not wait for a test. And I think what's happening in Ohio is we're waiting for periods of weeks, if not months, before we seek testing. And by that time, the traditional antibiotic therapies that we use may not be effective or as effective.
I wanted to introduce now, you're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Lyme disease and the deer tick, which is the most common spreader of it. Although Lyme disease is actually caught and treated with a week of antibiotics, as my guest Glenn Needham just said, sometimes if it's not caught in time, that kind of treatment doesn't work. And some cases, anyway, fall through the cracks. In 1995, Janet DeCesar was a working mom and an avid gardener. She was bitten by a tick, and 18 years later, she is still being treated with maintenance medications for Lyme disease. Janet is the author of the book Ticked Off, and she joins us by phone now. Welcome, Janet.
Hi. Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Janet, 18 years ago, what was your first clue that you had a problem?
Well, 1995 to 2000. We live on a family farm, and I was growing my own vegetables and fruits and herbs on my husband's family farm, and a 10-acre lot. There's plenty of work to do on the farm here. And we had a lot of deer because I live close to the Meander Reservoir. So last count was 25 deer traveling through here. Working out in the garden in my bare feet, I developed a red spot on my right foot, and I really didn't think anything too much about it. I just continued on with my routine. But then the ring, which they call a bullseye, there's a round circle with a center to it. It started to enlarge and kind of spread out across my foot. So I went to the first doctor to have him look at it, and he treated it and diagnosed it as a ringworm.
Mm-hmm.
So he put me on a topical cream for it, and I went home and I continued on with my routine and didn't think anything about it.
Until you got sick.
Until I got sick.
Really, really sick.
And, yes.
Have you had those tests that show definitively that you have
Lyme disease? Yes, I did 4 years later. I went for 4 years not knowing that I had Lyme disease. I had a Western blot test, a test called ELISA, it's E-L-I-S-A, and a urine test, and all three of them came back positive for Lyme disease.
Now, Glenn Needham, this is back in 1995, 1998, and so forth. That, I mean, to have something like that so long ago, where now you still say you're still struggling with the medical community in identifying and addressing this disease. Janet didn't have a snowflake's chance of getting the right kind of treatment right away, right?
I've heard her story over and over again, if not misdiagnosed as ringworm or something else. And then really, once you reach beyond that very early stage, you go into this no man's land of recognition of the problem and then trying to get a treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And for most medical professionals, they don't want to go beyond the standards of medical practice to treat this disease.
Which is the antibiotics.
Antibiotic. And so, and the other piece that's emerging now is more and more people are getting more than one disease with a single tick bite. They may be getting babesiosis, Bartonella. They might be getting ehrlichiosis. So we're seeing more and more people in Ohio with multiple infections from a single tick bite.
Janet DeCesar, when you were going through all of this, this is an illness that makes you very, very exhausted. It's flu-like symptoms. Did anyone ever suggest to you that it might be psychosomatic?
Yes, when I was in the last hospital, a doctor had my husband and my children pretty well convinced that I was making it all up, that I was lacking attention at home as a mother, and I needed to see a psychiatrist.
And Glenn Needham, have you heard those stories before as well?
Yeah, I hear them a lot because it really does affect your ability to think, your cognitive abilities, your memory. And obviously, your family picks up on this very quickly.
If somebody thinks they have Lyme disease, they've had a lot of the symptoms, why wouldn't they get those tests, that regimen of tests, to figure out definitively? Is there any reason why they wouldn't?
I think it's just recognition that the problem is here now. I think until we could show there were established populations of this tick in the state, I think they were reluctant to go down that road.
Huh.
And because Lyme disease and these other diseases mimic so many other things, it's so tough to tease apart with blood tests and everything, figure out what's wrong. And if you have multiple diseases, that makes it even more challenging for them.
Now, the tick in Ohio, it's being found throughout the state. Could you go over that again?
Sure. It's at least one black-legged tick has been found in 56 of Ohio's 88 counties.
Including southern Ohio?
In southern parts of southern Ohio.
Okay.
And then we think it's established in 26 counties in Ohio. And for sure it's in Ashtabula, Coshocton, Holmes, Muskingum, and Harrison counties where I found those populations on a regular basis.
And Franklin County?
We've found ticks here, but I can't tell you where there's an established population. But I have a permit to check in metro parks this summer, so we're going to start that process soon.
Janet, tell us about your treatment now. You're still being treated 18 years later, and it's with maintenance medications for Lyme disease. What does that involve?
I'm using a bicillin injection. It's 600,000 units of an antibiotic. And I do it every 10 to 15 days. My husband gives it to me. And I'm also doing a natural treatment with a naturopathic doctor. It consists of vitamins and supplements, but and everything's working very well. I just kind of consider that it's going to be something I'm going to have to do for the rest of my life to maintain me, and that's fine with me.
Have you ever tried to stop the medication just to see what happens?
Yes, I have tried to stop, and usually about 3 weeks into a month, I start having a lot of complications again. And it's really funny because my husband, he can pick up on it quicker than I can. I think a lot of it is a denial for me that I have to go back on the medication. But, you know, it's just something that you do. I'm very thankful that I have the opportunity that I can use this medication to help me along with it. And, it's just... Everybody has to make that decision for themselves, what's going to work best for them.
Glenn Needham, is there any sense about how many people in this country have Lyme disease?
That's a tough one because, CDC has its criteria that for official diagnosis, and then they have a set of criteria where they call it probable. And so in Ohio, as this unfolds, we're sort of sorting out what the risk level is. But on a national basis, 25 to 30,000 cases a year on a national level. And they say, CDC says, that's probably only 10% of the actual number of cases.
And of the ones that they know of,
right,
are those necessarily getting proper treatment?
I think that's, as your caller just said, that's almost an individual basis, how well that's going. And the challenge is finding a doctor who will have the patience to work with you to sort out what the issues are and how many tick-borne diseases you may have. And I think this is what we're seeing here in Ohio, more and more cases where the treatment for Lyme disease may be somewhat successful initially, but then later they find out they may have babesiosis and additional diseases that the first antibiotic treatment did not take care of.
We can treat our dogs with tick repellent, insecticides. Some people don't like to do it because they don't like to put insecticides in their dogs, but most people seem to think it's a good idea. But we can't treat ourselves to repel ticks.
Well, we can use, there's some good repellents we can use and just practices we can use, tucking our pants and our socks, our shirt into our pants, using permethrin, which is only for clothing, and DEET repellents at 25% or more to protect ourselves. And then doing tick checks on a daily basis and really looking for these little guys carefully, especially through the hair where these ticks will crawl up and attach. But I think another issue is the pet story. The veterinarians have a lot more tools in their tool chest for us than we do. And they have products they can put directly on the pet. And it's important where these ticks are common that cats and dogs be treated and follow the direction of their veterinarians, because the veterinarians will probably know in their local area what the risks are, whether they need to put their pets through this or not, as they start to see pets showing up with ticks and with symptoms for Lyme disease and spotted fever and the like.
Can a pet get
Lyme disease?
Yes,
they can. And as I'm going across the state talking to veterinarians, I'm hearing much more incidents of Lyme disease and, to some extent, Rocky Mountain spotted fever in dogs. For some reason, cats don't have symptoms to these diseases, but dogs do. So really, humans and dogs are the ones at the greatest risk from these tick-borne diseases.
Janet DeCesar, thanks so much for joining us today and sharing your story, and hope you continue to have good health.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you giving me the honor and letting me share my journey with everyone.
Janet DeCesar, she called us from Mineral Ridge, Ohio. And also, Glenn Needham, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, and hopefully we've raised some interest in this story.
Glenn Needham, he's a tick expert, a retired professor of entomology at OSU, and he now works with the university in the state on this issue. So thanks for listening to this. Moving on, we'll continue our conversation on Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Who are you?
I'm Peggy Olson, the new girl.
That's Elizabeth Moss as Peggy Olson and John Hamm as Don Draper in their first scene together on Mad Men. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Elizabeth Moss about how Peggy has changed over the past six seasons. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Joanne Folletta likes to conduct American symphonic music, so is there a Great American Symphony?
If we're going to think truly about Great American Symphonies, we have to expand what we might include in that category.
We'll ask her today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 till 7 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Meijer, a long-standing supporter of the American Red Cross's mission to provide assistance to victims when disaster strikes. Most recently, Meijer donated $500,000 to support Red Cross disaster relief efforts across the Midwest.
Enjoy America's favorite Independence Day celebration from Washington, D.C. on a Capitol 4th this Thursday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Hot flashes, night sweats, day sweats, insomnia, the symptoms of menopause vary among women, and those hardest hit can find themselves asking, why me? A scientific team asked the question, why anybody? Why do women go through menopause? Why are humans the only species that loses reproductive capabilities decades before the average age of death? John Stone, one of that study's co-authors, says it may have something to do with men. And he joins us now from Canada, where he is an associate professor in the Department of Biology and associate director of McMaster's Origins Institute. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, what did you use as a model? How did you produce the results of your study?
Well, we created a computer model, a computational model, which simulated and the equivalent of a human population evolving over time, males and females, mating, reproducing, producing offspring. Each individual is tracked for a certain amount of time, so they have an age. And we allowed mutations to evolve in the population. Some mutations affected the survival of individuals, and some affected the fertility of individuals.
How did you conclude that a male preference for younger females might have caused women to lose reproductive capabilities but not lose lifespan?
In the computational model, when we switch mating behavior so that men, males, and only young females reproduce, the effect of that is to relax selection at older ages in females. And so natural selection operates to remove traits that are negative in terms of an individual's fitness. And if individuals stop reproducing at older ages, mutations that have an onset during old ages can accumulate in a population over time and have effects like decreasing fertility. So in the computational model, when males mated with only young females, mutations that diminished fertility late in life accumulated in the females and ultimately led to a menopause phenotype.
Okay, so the idea is that the fertility was irrelevant anyway, so, and by losing your fertility, you would live longer because with fertility brought other kinds of dangers?
Well,
I'm trying to figure out still just because.
Yeah. The computational model allowed mutations that diminished fertility to evolve. It didn't affect any other traits specifically in the model.
Okay.
The hope is that in the real world, if there are counterparts for these type of mutations that accumulate and have effects in late age, then that maybe those alleles have effects on other traits. And maybe by identifying those genes, we can take action research to try to alleviate some of the other traits that are affected by these alleles.
Some have put a different spin or a modern spin, I suppose, on your conclusions, suggesting that modern males are part of modern patterns of menopause. Is that what you're talking about at all?
Well, the theory does say that if one gender preferentially mates with only younger members of the other gender, or as we put in the paper, it's equivalent that the other gender, the younger members, outcompete the older members, then that will affect these mutations. So it's possible, according to the theory that in the computational model, that this could be reversed. So in a sense, the activity that we're talking about occurred deep in our past, tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of years in the past, but theoretically, at least, the process would be reversible. And in fact, one of my colleagues is trying to see if he can evolve male fruit flies that have a menopause phenotype in the laboratory.
A different, more widely accepted theory for why humans go through menopause is the so-called grandmother hypothesis, the idea that it is beneficial to humans to have older, infertile females around to help raise the young. Dr. Kristen Hawkes at the University of Utah has studied the theory extensively and joins us now by phone. Welcome, Dr. Hawkes.
Thanks for the invitation.
Can't we both be grandmothers and fertile?
Can't we both be grandmothers and fertile? Absolutely. I bet you know a lot of women who are.
I do.
There you go.
More now than I did 50 years ago, too.
Yeah, it seems as though women are putting off their fertility and actually a lot of women getting into a corner as a consequence of forgetting the constraints on our biology because of our evolution. So we ought to talk about that, especially any of the young women listening.
It would almost make sense that women last beyond their reproductive years because there are younger, healthier people in their lives who love them and care for them. But the grandmother hypothesis states just the opposite. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, with all these things, so John Stone and his colleagues, it's great to have modelers interested in these questions because, you know, we don't really have a time machine to go back and see what happened in the past, so we have to use lots of other lines of evidence to sort of construct one, and modeling is a really important part of that. But as I'm sure he'd be the first to say, your model always depends on the assumptions that underlie it. And so I'm sort of an evolutionary biologist as well as an anthropologist, and our closest living relatives were part of the radiation of the hominids. The other living members of that radiation are the great apes, and all of us, human and female chimpanzees, female bonobos, female gorillas, female orangutans, fertility ends at about the same age in all of us. What's really different, well, among the things that are really different about humans, is our much greater longevity. So if you look at the radiation of the apes, these patterns of age-specific fertility and age-specific mortality, the thing that seems derived in us is our slower somatic aging, our greater longevity, and it looks like that's the thing we need to explain. How did it happen that we evolved this much greater longevity than our sister species and other members of the hominid radiation? How could that happen?
Uh-huh.
And the grandmother hypothesis is one possibility for which lots of pieces of evidence seem consistent with it. And, you know, again, much like what John Stone and his colleagues have done, I've been interested in modeling this question as well as looking at hunter-gatherer populations and, you know, what people of different ages and sexes do, and looking at the other primates. And we also have a computational model in which it turns out that if you add helpful grandmothers to helpful grandmothering, and here we made a simplifying assumption, the opposite of the one you just suggested. We only allowed females to act as helpful grandmothers when they didn't have their own babies. Hmm. And in our model, which, as it happened, appeared in print the same day that Professor Stone submitted his model to computational biology? Is that what it is?
Yes.
Yeah. And in our model, when you add helpful grandmothering, our ape-like model population evolves into a human-like population with human-like longevity and with the kind of proportion of older members of the population that we see in the living world when we look at hunter-gatherer populations, where mortality is a hell of a lot higher than our mortality, but the age structure of the population has this distinctive human feature that a substantial fraction of the adult women are past the childbearing ages.
Are these two models and their conclusions that you come to, are they necessarily mutually exclusive?
Well, I mean, I'm happy to let Professor Stone speak first, but I also would, you know.
Oh, no, go ahead, Dr. Hawks, and I'll go to Dr. Stone, sure.
Right. Well, we have really different assumptions about the ancestral state and the question that needs explaining. So the question they asked was not how do you get the kind of longevity that we have. They just assumed it was there. And they assumed an ancestral population in which fertility continued in women to much older ages. So they just kind of started with that. That from our perspective, how would you ever get that? We don't see that mm-hmm. in any of the living apes. And, you know, science has this problem, you know, you can never rule out that it was really Martians that did it or something. But
right. But
we try to take all of these pieces of evidence and put them together to construct what seems the most likely. And having an ancestral population in which fertility continued to much later ages would be tricky. You'd have to account for that in some way, and we didn't start with that, and so we had a different question we were trying to answer.
John Stone,
yeah, we were trying to address the problem of if lifespan was extended, why male fertility extended into late life, whereas female fertility didn't. So we started, as Dr. Hawks had suggested, from a very different initial assumption that both genders could reproduce into old age, and try to explain how menopause phenotype could evolve as a consequence of mutation.
Dr. Hawks, does fertility take a lot of energy? It didn't. I seemed a lot more energetic. But then I think, well, I was burning a lot more energy then, right? And so I'm, you know, maybe I'll last longer if I'm not burning all that energy. I don't know. I mean, obviously I'm not a doctor, but I'm just wondering about that energy saving and therefore life extending benefit to menopause.
Right. So always with these things, you know, it depends. Everything always depends on what's the question you're trying to answer.
Right.
There, and again, this is also part of what kind of assumptions we want to make. So you can't find a mammal in which, I don't think, now maybe John Stone can correct me on this, but in general, what determines how many babies get born is actually the females who are ready for a conception. And you can have, well, for example, in primates, including humans, you know, a female can kind of max one baby a year, but a male can actually father gazillions, if the other male would let him. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the problem for males is the other males that are competing for all those paternities. But that they built into their model an assumption about the way pairing worked, which, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm sure they must have thought about this a lot, how they're going to set this up. It's, again, it's a set of assumptions that at least seem very inconsistent with what we know about this animal, humans, and not consistent with what we know about the other apes or the other primates. So,
Professor Stone, what other data does support it? What kind of sociological or other data did you assume? Where did you get that from to make those assumptions?
Well, our model is a genetic model, so we look at the accumulation of genes that have a negative effect on fertility.
Okay.
All the other parameters that we included in the model were obtained from standard fertility tables and survivorship tables.
Well, no, you made an assumption about pairs, right? That's really crucial that pulled out a male and a female, and then the question was whether or not there was actually going to be a conception.
Yeah, and that was those were determined on the basis of the fertility and survivorship tables.
So I kind of get the feeling that you're at odds with each other then? Yeah.
Well, as Dr. Hawks mentioned, we attempt to answer certain questions, and we employ models to answer those questions, and the details of those models determine the answers to those questions. And we can disagree on the details of the models, and but I think we would agree that what you mentioned before about hypotheses being non-mutually exclusive, it's from our perspective, the model that we produced gives one account of how a menopause phenotype could evolve, one that requires only a switch in mating behavior and the accumulation of mutations. So it's a very specific question we're trying to address.
And going, looking at how we things are today, at least in our society to some degree, women are having babies much older now. And they're waiting a lot longer, and that means the men are having the babies with them. I mean, they're impregnating in them. If this model was extrapolated in another direction, could it go there?
Gee, we really are constrained about by things about our biology, about female or mammalian reproductive biology is really weird and complicated. We have all the eggs we're ever going to have when we're 5-month-old fetuses,
right?
And we start losing them from there. So the biology of the production of gametes in the two sexes is really different. It's one of the reasons that males can readily continue to produce sperm to older ages. The way it works for female mammals, you know, and we are mammals, and we are primates, and we are apes. There is this constraint that we start out with that many eggs, and then we lose them, and we start losing them even before we're born. We keep losing them before menarche. We keep losing them whether we're pregnant or lactating, or they just keep going away, and they're going away at the same rate that they're going away in chimpanzees. So
okay.
I wanted to break in to say to the young women out there who are putting off their fertility, they need to take that on board.
Okay. Okay. If it should ever go the other direction, it's not happening fast enough to help us listening today, right?
I'm afraid so. Right.
Well,
we want it to.
Exactly. Well, Dr. John Stone, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this. It's intriguing, and I would imagine it's a topic that will continue on.
I certainly think it will.
Dr. John Stone, he's an associate professor in the Department of Biology and the associate director of the McMaster's Origins Institute. Also with us, Kristen Hawks. She is a professor of anthropology at the University of Utah. Dr. Hawks, thanks as well to you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for the invitation.
Thanks to the All Side staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karam Shaban, Shannon Clary, Leticia Wiggins, and Emmanuel Jochi, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Couldn't operate without our radio operations director, Kevin Petrilla, senior broadcast technician, Eric French, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson. Everybody have a very, very happy holiday, and thanks for listening today. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of The Ohio State University.